History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as some of us are willing to ask a few questions and, more importantly, to listen patiently enough for long-buried memories to return to the forefront once more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Just a warning before we really get started today that the subject matter can be difficult to talk about, difficult to hear about, difficult to even think about. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard from quite a few World War II veterans who struggled to put into words what it was they witnessed when encountering Nazi concentration camps in Europe. It was at this time of year, 77 years ago, that the world was learning the true extent of the Holocaust. And earlier this week in Jerusalem at Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Center, a ceremony was held to mark Holocaust Remembrance Day. You're going to hear a few excerpts from that today, along with accounts from some of the Americans who have shared their concentration camp liberation memories here on Hometown Heroes over the years. If you'd like to watch the entire ceremony from Yad Vashem, I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as on the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Perhaps the most powerful part of the ceremony comes right up front, when six Holocaust survivors light a memorial torch in honor of the victims, one torchlighter for every 1 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. Yad Vashem has posted videos from each of this year's torchlighters detailing their memories, and I don't think there's any better way to set the tone for our program today than to hear an excerpt from Yad Vashem's video with torchlighter Olga K., a native of Hungary who lived in the United States for nearly 40 years after World War II and now makes her home in Israel.
I come from a family of 10 children. My parents were just the most wonderful people. It was Pesach, Shabbos night. They started together, the Jewish family. Our turn was on Tuesday morning. We were taken to a cattle train, nothing to sit down. We didn't get any food for 3 days. We didn't know anything what's going on. We did not know where we are going. When we arrived to Auschwitz, I wanted to take a pair of stocking, something, some clothing with me as we are getting off. And my father told me, "My dear, you don't need that anymore." I got off the train. First, my father was separated. My younger sister and I were sent ahead and were taken to Lager C. We were asked to take off all our clothes with all the German men around. And then they cut off our hair and from everywhere, from our body. My mother and my sister and two grandchildren, they were sent to the gas chamber. They were, it's hard for me to say, do I have to? They took the very sick ones, took also my little sister downstairs. Then one day when I went down, I thought she was sleeping and I wanted to cover her. And the girls around her in the room said, "You don't need to cover her anymore." I must tell my story because the world is trying to deny it. No matter how hard it is, I just have to tell.
And she continues to do just that. Olga K., one of this year's torchlighters at Yad Vashem on Holocaust Remembrance Day. Olga's daughter, Judy Cohen, published the family's story in a book called Song of the Silent Bell, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. At this time, 77 years ago, the world was just starting to comprehend the full extent of what the Nazi regime had called its final solution as concentration camps throughout Europe began to be liberated. The first camp to experience liberation was Ohrdruf, a subcamp of Buchenwald. One of the first Americans to arrive there was Ralph Rush, a 23-year-old with the Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon of Headquarters Company, 355th Infantry Regiment, 89th Infantry Division.
We were sent out on patrol one morning, very early, and were told we might find something special, but we didn't know what it was for sure.
Huh.
But I think it was some of our air guys that spotted it. I was told to take my squad. There were just six of us, and check out this facility that they'd been able to spot. And they gave me the coordinates and sent a tank with me, one tank. Then the rest of my guys that were, well, there was six of us in jeeps. And we spotted on the hill some fencing, metal fencing. And it was pretty heavy duty and pretty thorough, height-wise. So we headed for it. The closer we got to it, the more we realized it was a big, pretty big place.
And this is April 4th, 1945. There hasn't been a single concentration camp liberated yet
No.
or discovered by the Americans.
That's right. There was talk of something of that nature, but no specifics.
So you haven't heard stories, you haven't seen images, you have no idea what you're stumbling across.
No, not at all.
So you see the fence, you head toward it.
We head for it, and at the gate, I was first one in, and there were just six of us that were with weapons there. And here at the gate, inside, it's sort of a double gate, are six young men that had just been executed.
And you had heard something, I think, hadn't you?
Yeah, we heard some shooting, and so we went cautious as hell.
Well, you're on the way there, you heard shots, but you didn't see anything heading your way.
No.
So then you get there, and you see these bodies, and that tells you what the shots were?
Yep, there were six bodies. The blood was there and what have you. So it was just been done, like it meant was meant as a token to us or something of this nature, or a warning to us, whatever you might say. There's either six or eight. Three were Americans.
How could you tell?
The way their patches were on their arms.
They were in uniform.
They were in uniform.
So they had been captured.
They had been captured and then executed.
So that's a little alarming.
It shook us up pretty bad.
And who were the other ones?
They were British. But when we went in very carefully because we didn't know Well, we began to see like three or four football fields in a row. And down at the bottom of it, not quite all the way, but was a railroad track where they had been burning and were still burning bodies. There were headquarters building and all the rest of it there. And I didn't want us to get caught in a bad spot. So the six of us, I divided them up. You do this and do this and so on. And I went through the buildings that were there. There were some headquarter buildings to see if there's by any chance anyone there that would be. Well, I didn't know for sure what the hell we had.
Yeah, someone could be waiting to kill you.
Yeah. So we went by twos to the buildings. And they were fairly high buildings. So then we came down as it began to get lighter. Here were, and I've got some pictures of some of the bodies. What they'd done was taken prisoners, and I think these are mostly Germans who weren't Nazis.
Uh-huh.
They had been gassed or poisoned, and then their bodies were put in rail cars. They were sort of an open-air rail car, full, absolutely right to the brim, boxes of bodies.
I know you've told your story many times over the years, so you're used to describing this now. But at the time, as a young man who's never seen anything like this before.
God, it just really throws you. And we were six of us and quite a few of the Germans there. And I was concerned that we might be trapping ourselves. And we had to be pretty darn careful. But that's what was happening, was bodies are being delivered from some central point.
You saw these cars actually coming down the railroad.
And being burnt.
So it almost leaves you with the impression that this is an effort to burn the evidence, to hide the truth of what had happened there.
Yes, you're suspicious of that. A young man, pretty sure he was Polish.
How old do you think?
About my age, maybe a little bit older than I.
In his 20s?
Yeah, in his 20s, maybe late 20s. He couldn't speak English, but he was doing his best to get our attention. He came up to me. He'd come up to one of my other guys, too. He came up to me, and he said, in a language I couldn't quite understand, but there's enough so I could pick up, that he wanted a gun, because he explained to us that the Germans that were doing this final stages, burning the bodies and things of this nature and moving the bodies down to be burned, they are taking the clothing from the guys that were, they were using to burn.
So the Germans were basically hiding out in the uniforms that the prisoners had to wear.
Right.
So they're disguising themselves as prisoners, thinking that they can get away.
That's right.
And this is what this young Polish boy is telling you, but you've never met him before. You can't even really understand him, and he's asking you to give him a gun. How do you know he's not one of the Germans?
Well, that was a big decision I had to make. And I made the decision based on my hunch that he was right. So I gave him a gun, gave him some ammunition, gave him, I happened to have stopped a German on the way to the hospital some weeks before. He had a Luger on him and some bullets and all the rest of it. And because he said that, as I finally got to understand that the guys that were responsible for this thing, he convinced me anyway that what he was doing was right. I took the chance, gave him a gun, gave him some ammunition.
He takes the Luger and several clips of bullets.
Yeah, I could hear the shooting going on and so forth. So he shot quite a few people who were trying to get out, knowing that we were somehow knew we were there and that they were going to get hung or executed. He came out at the end. He was crying, and he said he used every bullet that he could find in addition to the bullets that I'd given him, because he found bullets on the guys that were working there in the yard. As I say, he was crying. It was dark by then. He'd been at it quite a while. I'd heard quite a bit of shooting going on. And he gave me a silver watch on a silver chain. And I told him that the war's going to be over before you know it, and you need to keep this for yourself, because it's about the only thing that you've been able to hide and keep. And he insisted I take the watch. It had a chain on it that was probably about a foot long. Beautiful silver chain and watch. Unfortunately, someone stole it out of my bag months later. Mm. So I didn't have it. But he insisted that I take the...
He just wanted to show his gratitude for your giving him the chance to do what he did.
To get even with some of the terrible people that were in that facility. It's hard to believe how big it was. I mean, it was about like 3 football fields or 4 football fields in size. It was a big operation.
And that's what I want to ask you about. So this whole time that he has borrowed this gun from you and is going out to find those who had been torturing and exterminating the prisoners and were trying to escape, what were you doing that whole time? Are you exploring the camp?
We're exploring the camp to see if we can find out for sure what's going on and who was doing it.
What else did you see there that sticks with you today?
I think the thing that sticks with me more than anything is the bodies that were being prepared for the burning. There are so many of them, like you might see in a slaughterhouse. I have some pictures of them that make you ill almost to see.
Did you feel ill there?
Yes. It's so terrible. It's hard to believe that some group could do as many dangerous things as that and be so rotten. I mean, it just makes you feel like what you were doing was certainly worth the time and effort. Thinking of the bodies of the boys that were killed there, that we're sorry we didn't get there sooner, or something of that nature.
Yeah.
They had just been executed. Well, you feel like you'd like to be able to do something a little more penetrating. Hard to fathom, hard to believe that one person could do it to another. Just at such a scale, such an incredible scale. Terrible, terrible. And to figure that as we went along, how many more of those type of camps were around. But this had to be a major one.
It was the first one liberated, Ohrdruf, yeah. Have you ever been back there?
No, I have not.
And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but no. I've talked to so many guys who just witnessed a concentration camp. But you were witnessing the very first one that Americans stumbled across when bodies are still being burned.
Yeah.
You're seeing the people that were killed and some that were left alive and the horrible state that their bodies were in, how malnourished and, you know, in what bad shape they are. Is that something that affects you still today, what you went through there?
Yes, it does affect me. I wake up in the middle of the nights still with the terror of what must have been given to all of those folks that were so terribly treated. You can't believe that a person could do for another those kind of things. It just, it's beyond comprehension. But once you see what I saw in that concentration camp, there's no room for... You can feel sorry for the people, but you can't feel sorry for the Germans that caused so much misery.
Have you ever encountered anybody who told you that they don't believe the Holocaust happened?
I've heard of people saying that, but no one's ever talked to me that's asked me that question or told me that they don't believe that the Holocaust occurred.
How would you respond?
I'd have to tell them that their source is pretty lousy, because believe me, it's the truth. It's not somebody's guess or somebody's over the night dreaming or something of this nature. It's fact. It's terrible. It's horrible what occurred.
You were there. You saw it.
I saw it, and it will never be out of my mind.
Have you found anything that's helped you handle it better?
I think the most important thing to me has been for people to find out and know for sure that this is what happened and what went on. And we can't stand to have it again. That's, I think, the most important thing to me.
That's why you tell your story, in the hopes that people will learn and not let this happen again.
Yes, that's right. I don't try to make a deal of it or anything of that nature. But if it comes up, I don't hesitate to say something, because this generation of ours needs to understand those things can happen again. It's inhuman. It took me a long time, but I don't mind talking to groups or any other thing, if that little bit would help prevent it from happening again.
You know, I wasn't going to ask you this, but hearing you discuss things the way you are and sharing it, I think you can handle this question. The young man that you gave that Luger to.
Yes.
Knowing anything can happen here. He could turn it around and shoot me. He can go kill whoever. And then hearing those shots and knowing that people are dying. Did you ever regret that or have remorse over that? Or wonder if you did the right thing?
No. The young man, he was so forceful. And the way he handled himself, he went right back into the fray when we were there. He could have shot us and what have you. But something about it told me that he was telling me the truth. And then I was seeing the truth. As I said, I wake up at night still just remembering, not worrying about it, but remembering. And I don't ever hesitate to talk to a group of people if they're willing to listen. So your being here and listening to me is much appreciated. It's hard to spread this kind of information without being thought of as maybe a damn fool or some other such thing.
Well, and I can feel in the way you're talking about it, the burden that you've carried for all these years. Know that it hasn't been easy.
No, it hasn't been easy. But I'd do it again if I had to.
Haunting, powerful words from the late Ralph Rush carry so much relevance in a week where remembrance is the operative word. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more memories from World War II veterans who witnessed this painful chapter of history, and more excerpts from that Holocaust remembrance ceremony at Yad Vashem as well. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down. 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day, observed in Jerusalem this past week with a special ceremony at Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Center. I have a video of the entire ceremony linked online for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Just a reminder, though, that some of the details discussed today, whether from World War II veterans who have shared their stories on Hometown Heroes or from the ceremony this week in Israel, can be very difficult to hear. If you have young children with you and you're concerned it may be too much for them to digest, I just want to repeat that advanced warning for you. One of the speakers at Yad Vashem's torchlighting ceremony this week was the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, who addressed the crowd in Hebrew. In this excerpt, you'll hear the English translator.
There are moments in which one black and white photo tells the whole story, reverberates all of the words. I am standing here before you as I carry with me, etched in my heart, such a photo, a rare picture that anyone who has seen it will never be able to forget. The eyes see it, the brain perceives it, but the soul does not want to believe it, that the black and white is actually darker than black. It is not a picture of the big numbers, the thousands, the tens of thousands, the millions. It is a photo of one family, a Jewish family, a family executed by the Nazi satanic henchmen and their collaborators. A mother and her son at the edge of the pit. The barrels of the rifles touching her back. You cannot see the face of the woman, nor the faces of her children. A moment before her body collapses into the pit of death, she bends down towards her young children. And in one moment, all the rifles emit smoke. They shoot her together. They do not suffice with one bullet. They are coordinated, efficient. One child falls beneath her. With whatever power she has left in her, the mother holds the hand of her young son, who is sitting barefoot on his knees on the blood-drenched land. What did the mother whisper to her little son? Did she tell him not to cry? And the boy, did he cry? Did he keep quiet? Did he understand? Was he afraid? The picture is silent, but its voice cries out, shocking, mesmerizing. Thou shalt not kill. Lay not thine hand upon the lad. You may take the young, but be sure to let the mother go. Do not slaughter a cow or a sheep and its young on the same day. The photo was taken on October 13, 1941. When I saw it in Wendy Lauer's book, a book that was all about this picture, focusing only on it, I felt my entire being overcome with sadness, rage, and pain. These atrocities occurred in so many towns and villages, more than we can count, and in all of them, the sun shined over the valley, birds chirped, the forest was quiet, and the slayer slew and slew and slew. Like wheat sheaf falling behind the harvester, the Jews fell into the pit, and there was no one to collect them. The massive killing of the Jewish people, humanity's darkest hour, started like this in what was later called the Holocaust in bullets. Afterwards, the Nazi beast that could not be satiated accelerated the extermination processes until it reached a monstrous scale. Millions of our people were tortured, murdered, massacred by the most horrific machine of evil known to mankind. Brothers and sisters, 3 years after the gates of camps opened up, Holocaust survivors became the heroes of the resurrection, a miracle, role models, and a symbol. The state of the Jews was established like a beacon expressing the triumph of light over darkness, promising that a Jewish child will never have to hide in a dark and isolated cellar from those who seek to kill him. Parents will never be torn from their children and set on their last journey only because they were Jews. And never, ever will despicable murderers stand behind a Jewish family, shoot them, and throw them into the valley of the shadow of death.
Just a snippet there from Yad Vashem's Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony and the words of Israeli President Isaac Herzog. You can watch his whole speech and see that photograph he referenced at hometownheroesradio.com. A relevant book on this topic that I also have linked for you online is The Liberator by prolific World War II author Alex Kershaw. It focuses on the liberation of the Dachau concentration camp by the 3rd Battalion, 157th Infantry Regiment, part of the 45th Infantry Division. Colonel Felix Sparks is the protagonist of Kershaw's book. Rex Rainey, then a 23-year-old from Western Colorado, was one of those young Americans who followed Sparks into a scene he never could have conceived.
We were about an hour after the camp was entered before we got in there. I don't think we had an hour before we were ready to go back. And then from then on, it was a simple march into Munich, and the war was over.
Did you see any of the survivors of the
camp? Oh, yes. Yes, they would come and try to claw on you, get you to take them out. But they were walking skin and bones. I didn't see near all of them, but yes, I saw probably, 50 or 100.
You saw enough to get a feel for what had happened there and what kind of
too much
cruelty people were capable of. I don't want to make you dwell on it. But any time I meet someone like you who was there, and I think I mentioned to you, my grandfather was at Buchenwald when it was liberated. It's not just a straw dog. There actually are people in this world that don't think that happened, that think it was all made up. And you were there. You saw it.
I'd hate to tell you how many people were dead or dying in stock cars, in gondolas. Some of them were half in and half out of a train, couldn't move anymore. You can't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like, really. And I spent about an hour there.
Yeah. And maybe not in the moment, but eventually, did that experience and your coming face to face with that give you maybe even a new understanding or appreciation for how important the work that you'd been doing over there was?
It made you do a little thinking. It made you willing to travel to Denver when that Colonel Sparks arranged for a marker in remembrance of the Holocaust to be placed.
The memories of what he witnessed at Dachau remained with Rex Rainey until his passing in 2018. It was never easy to talk about, but he did so in order that we would understand and that we would remember. A few times over the years, we've encountered veterans who witnessed elements of the Holocaust but had never spoken about it. Such was the case in South Bend, Indiana, with Paul Davis, who as a 20-year-old serving in Europe had heard rumors about how the Nazi regime was treating Jews and other political prisoners.
We didn't hear anything more than anybody else did, but we didn't realize it was near as bad as what it was until we did liberate that one camp.
Yeah.
And boy, when we let them people go free, they were running.
If they could, if they were able, and a lot of them weren't.
Right.
And you just showed me some photos that you took there.
Yes, with my little brownie box camera.
Brownie box camera. And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but this is the truth. You told me as you were showing me those pictures that your children have never seen them.
Right.
It's more than 70 years ago.
You never have seen them, dude. She didn't want to look at them tonight.
Well, and I don't blame anyone for not wanting to look. But there was a reason that you took them.
Right.
Can you, I know it's not easy to talk about, and everyone can hear the emotion in your voice, and I can see it on your face. Can you describe for us what you saw, what that experience was like, and what it did to you?
Well, I never thought anything like that could happen to a human being. And it was terrible to have to see that.
You saw people who were literally a shadow of their former selves, like less than half their body weight.
Right.
Skeletons with a little skin on them.
Right.
Some dead, some alive.
Right.
You saw a crematorium where bodies had been burned?
Yes. That's the one picture I had there of the crematorium.
You saw bodies piled on the ground?
Right.
What did you see on the faces of those concentration camp victims who were still alive when you got there?
Well, they were so happy to see us and that they could leave there. Where they went, I don't know. But they were sure happy to get out of that camp.
Well, and when I talk to people like you who experience that, I often wonder about the timing of it all. Mm-hmm. If you see so many dead and you see so many close to death, how many more would have been dead a day later, a week later?
Right. And a lot of them were Jewish.
Yeah. And as hard as it is to believe, there are people in the world today who are saying that none of this happened.
Right.
What do you say to them?
I said, I was there. I seen it. I know what happened.
And all these years later, does it give you some satisfaction to know that you and those guys that you went through there with that liberated that camp, that you very well could have saved those people's lives?
Right. We'd have been there sooner.
Well, and even the people that were still alive there. I mean, had you not come through when you came through, who knows?
Yeah.
Was there any other part of that experience at a concentration camp? And I'm sure you were probably only there for, what, a few hours?
No, I'd say we were there for a couple of days.
Oh, you were that long?
Yes.
Did you have to clean some things up?
Yes. We helped with some of the bodies.
You had to move dead bodies?
Yes. It was hard, but we did it.
You're not even 21 years old?
No. It's hard to realize that anybody could treat a human being like that.
Yeah. Well, and who knows how many more people that would have happened to if that Nazi war machine had been allowed to achieve victory.
Right.
Yeah, I guess that's a question. You know that this war is nearing its end by this time.
Mm-hmm.
But did seeing that add to the motivation or resolve you already had?
Yes.
Give you a clear understanding of what you're fighting for?
That's right. The people in the United States don't realize how lucky they are.
The late Paul Davis, another witness to what really happened in World War II, another veteran who believes so strongly that as difficult as it can be to discuss, the history of the Holocaust should never be forgotten, rewritten, or erased. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a decorated American veteran who lost most of his family to Hitler's forces of extermination. This special episode of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major major transportation arteries, CVTR, has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in light of Holocaust Remembrance Day, or as they officially call the start of that observation at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, Holocaust Martyrs and Heroes Day. In a moment, we're going to hear recollections from a decorated U.S. soldier who fled his native Germany because of the Holocaust and later donated some of his mementos to Yad Vashem as well as the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. But first, one more brief excerpt from this week's ceremony. You can watch it in its entirety at hometownheroesradio.com. This is the Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, speaking in Hebrew with an English translator.
Brothers and sisters, the Holocaust is an unprecedented event in human history. I am stating this fact because as the years go by, we hear some people in the world comparing other difficult events to the Holocaust. But no. Even the most difficult wars today are not the Holocaust and are nothing like the Holocaust. No event in history, cruel as it may be, comes close to the extermination of European Jews by the Nazis and their collaborators. History, unfortunately, is rife with tough wars, brutal murders, and genocide. The case of the extermination of the Jews is different. Never, at no other place, and at no other time, has one nation acted to exterminate another in such a premeditated, systematic, industrial way, out of pure ideology.
Some of the points made this week on Holocaust Remembrance Day by Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, speaking at Yad Vashem, where if you visit today, you could find items donated by Oscar Rice, a groundbreaking scientist who would eventually help identify the biomarkers for prostate cancer. If you've ever taken a PSA test, he's one of the people you have to thank. Oscar would earn the Silver Star and the Purple Heart during his World War II service with the 79th Infantry Division in Europe, a fight that for him was not just patriotic, but also intensely personal. Oscar grew up in a Jewish family in the suburbs of Munich.
Interestingly enough, I went, of course, to a Catholic grammar school, but then Hitler in 33 or 4 decreed that Jews had to go to Jewish schools. So then I went to an Orthodox Jewish school in Munich. And then after that, after I graduated, I went to Altes Real Gymnasium, which is the same thing as a high school, but much more advanced. So until Hitler gave in the full power, till 35, 36, there was no problem go to the school. But the Hitler Youth started to really harass me, us, the Jewish people. In wintertime, they throw snowballs at us that had an accident. And I went to school in a bicycle. They were in the air of the bicycle, ruining the bicycles too. And then one of the Hitler Youth that sat behind me was carrying a long knife, stick the knife in my back and said, when there were tests, especially math tests, where I was very good at, let's change tests.
Wow.
So my father said, you got to get out of here. So I applied both for a visa to the United States and for a visa to go to Palestine. I had a very close friend, high school friend, Richard Blanchest. When I got the visa to come to the United States, I wanted to go with him, of course. But my mother says you're going to the United States. So at 17, in those days, you don't disagree with your parents.
Well, yeah, but they're telling you it's not safe for you here. You have to go to America. You don't speak any English.
Yeah.
So you're sailing across the Atlantic Ocean.
But she knew where I was going because her aunt, who sponsored me, had connections with the ag school I went to.
An ag school that's now called Delaware Valley
University.
What you studied there was how to be a dairyman, right?
Well, that was my major. I also learned how to do other work, like to plow fields and spray orchard. They had five different departments.
Uh-huh.
What helped me with my English was the head of floriculture had got his degree from Heidelberg University and was fluent in German.
Uh-huh.
So as long as I was with him in the department, he helped me with my language.
So you picked up English pretty quick.
Yes. In 6 months, it was all right.
So you're over here. Your whole family is still in Germany. You're studying at this basically agricultural school, National Farm School it was called then. You end up getting out of there and running a dairy. But over this time period, how often did you hear from your family back home?
Very rarely, very rarely.
You had to be concerned about him, knowing what Hitler was about.
Of course. Then I asked my aunt to also give him visas, and she applied for it. But by the time the mail got to my parents, the American embassy in Stuttgart had closed because of the war, and there was nothing to be done anymore.
And if your parents had waited a year, 2 years longer, you might not have made it to America.
Right.
But your little sister did.
Yeah. She went through southern France. But she was so traumatized, she didn't remember how the whole thing happened.
Your parents had the foresight to help you and flee this situation, but they were stuck there.
And my sister, because we had relatives in Alsace-Lorraine, and they sent my sister, after the war has broken out, to Alsace-Lorraine. And then she went to southern France, around Marseille somewhere, and came to the United States.
Yeah, so here you've graduated from this university, and now you're running a dairy farm in Maryland, not far from Washington, D.C. You did that for a couple years. They didn't need you for the war. They needed you in that job. And then when you decided that you might want to get in this war and go fight the man who's persecuting your family and so many others, they said, no, you can't. You're an enemy.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's happened to your family, right?
Right. Absolutely no idea.
And you've got both your parents and your brother are still back there.
And my grandparents.
And your grandparents.
All my grandparents.
And I can't imagine what that feels like, to be completely cut off and no idea and knowing that people are being persecuted and horrible things are happening. But by 1943, they decide, oh, we changed our mind. We need some bodies now.
Well, the reason is that I worked in the creamery, so I wasn't essential anymore.
So since you stopped working at the creamery, you didn't have an exemption anymore?
Well, I don't know. I just got a letter from the draft board.
Uh-huh.
We report for induction.
But you're still not a U.S. citizen.
Nope.
You go into the Army. You're training.
Fort McCallum.
So you're out there shooting a machine gun?
Yeah.
And what did they do? They had you change targets real fast or something?
Yeah.
And they noticed how good you were at that?
Yeah.
Because you were real sharp in math. You could make the adjustments.
Yeah.
And so then they came to talk to you?
Yeah.
And they heard your accent.
Yeah.
What happened then?
Well, he said, we need you in Germany.
He realized you spoke German.
Yeah, fluent German. He says, we need you in Germany.
And he meant right then.
Right there. And he says, we can't send you because you're not a citizen. We got to make you a citizen.
So how'd they do that?
Well, they took me to the courthouse in Anniston, Alabama. The colonel went to see the judge and explained the situation to him. After I filled out all the forms, I went into the judge's chamber. And the judge looked at me and says, do you know anything about the Constitution? And I waved my pamphlet the Army had given me and says, yes, I've read it. And he said, you're a citizen.
Just like that.
And 3 weeks later, I was in Germany.
They put you in the 79th Infantry Division.
Yeah.
You got there right as the Battle of the Bulge is going on, right?
Yeah, right. We were protecting the right flank of Patton's in the Battle of the Bulge.
Now, you had grown up in Germany.
Yeah.
I know. I'm sure you'd had some rough winters.
Oh, yeah.
But what was that like, that winter of 44?
Digging a foxhole was terrible. It wasn't nice, let me put it this way. But I managed all right.
As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, I told all my companions to not call me Oscar by first name because it's so Germanic. I used my middle name, Kully, K-U-L-L-Y.
Uh-huh.
That's my mother's maiden name was Kullmann. So that's why I'm Kully. Then I could overhear a lot of the German conversations, which helped us so strategically.
So if you had gone by Oscar, the enemy would have been tipped off and wouldn't have spoken German so freely.
Yeah.
But you're in a combat situation.
Oh, yeah.
You've got the enemy firing at you, and you're firing at them.
Oh, yeah. One night I went through a night patrol with an American Indian, a corporal. I learned how to behave in the woods at night. He knew his way around. He's the one that taught me how to stay alive under those conditions.
Did you think you were going to stay alive?
I had doubts because we were getting attacked by tanks and all this sort of thing.
And how often? I mean, here you are.
Yeah.
You're back in Europe. You're so close to your family, in theory.
Yeah.
But you still don't know what's happened to them.
Right.
How often did you think about that?
Oh, constantly, of course.
And you're fighting this regime that is the reason you left Germany.
Well, yeah. That had something to do with my motivation. I rewarded the Silver Star.
You mentioned the Silver Star. So this takes place long after the Battle of the Bulge, after you guys, by hook or by crook, made it across the Rhine, which wasn't easy for you. And you're in a foxhole looking out, and what do you see?
I see movement, and I know what people. And in a foxhole, I know it was on the German side, so it must have been Germans.
And how far away were they?
About 100 yards.
And how many of them were there?
Well, actually, two. The army said three, but there was only two.
And what did you decide to do?
I decided to take my radio off and crawl in a ditch with my carbine. That took me within, maybe 5 feet of that foxhole. I got out, cocked my carbine first, of course, jumped out of the foxhole and told them the Germans to surrender.
And you said that in German?
In German, yeah.
Yeah.
And they immediately surrendered. Didn't have to do anything.
But that's a long way to crawl. And if you had alerted them somehow with some mistake before you got there.
Oh, yeah.
They would have shot you.
Yeah, of course.
So you were taking your life into your hands by doing this.
There's no question about that.
So you tell them to surrender. They do. And you say, now you have to follow me back over here.
Yeah, I follow you.
You force them to go. Yeah, exactly. And you notice something in their possession.
Yeah.
This is one of the reasons you got the Silver Star.
Yeah.
Tell me what you found.
I found a German map that had marked clearly the coordinates of the guns that they were using to destroy the pontoon bridge.
And this is why you had such a hard time getting across the Rhine.
Yeah.
They kept blowing up the pontoon bridge or the engineers' efforts to build one.
Yeah.
You discover this map. It's got the gun positions.
We radioed back immediately the coordinates of the gun position.
And what happened next?
The guns started firing.
Not just any guns.
No, those were the kinds of size that the battleships had. They were sitting on the other side of the Rhine. They had to be taken apart. They were not type of guns that couldn't move. There was emplacements.
That's why I'm asking, because when people hear big guns, they think we're talking about maybe at most a 155.
Yeah.
This is a 250?
50 millimeter, yeah. At least that's what they told me. And they had to be taken apart into three pieces to be transported.
But they know exactly where to fire because of the map that you found.
Yeah.
So here you are back in your position, and you've got quite a show to behold.
Yeah.
Tell me what you saw and what you heard.
Well, they told us to get our heads down in the foxhole in case there was a short round. And they started firing for 15 minutes, TOT, time on target, and the shells going overhead sounded like a freight train going overhead. And I learned later, I didn't see the place, but the friends of mine that saw the place where the guns were said they were totally destroyed.
I would imagine so, with artillery of that caliber heading their way. And that's significant. I mean, the reason they're giving you the Silver Star is by capturing these guys, finding that map, they're able to destroy all these guns.
Yeah.
That allows them to get across the Rhine, and it probably saved a lot of American lives.
Sure.
Did you realize that at the time, how significant that was?
No, I didn't. That was a job. You know, when you're on the front line, see what a job that needs to be done. You don't worry about anything else. They say, how can I get it done?
and saved my life.
Just 3 days after those heroics that earned him the Silver Star, he was wounded by shrapnel from a mortar shell. He always said the radio strapped to his back probably saved his life by protecting his internal organs. But through all of those harrowing days in combat, even crossing back into his native Germany, he still had no report, no information, no final word on what had become of his family there that he'd been forced to leave behind.
No, not until I went to Munich, to the headquarters where all the records were kept, and looked at the records. And I found out later the records were not accurate.
Well, I want to understand what this was like for you. And again, keeping in mind that you're still a very young man. So you're ordered to Nuremberg, and they're going to have you interrogate war criminals because you speak such great German.
Yeah.
Now, these are the war criminals that wanted to kill you and any other Jew they could find.
Yeah.
But to that point, you were okay with that idea.
I was hesitant even then.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say. I was not ready to tell my colonel no.
Sure.
But after seeing the records.
So tell me about this. So you go to Munich, and what's in Munich?
All the records are kept in Munich.
And you mean all the records from the entire Holocaust?
Yeah. They were later transferred to another place, and any correction were made. The Holocaust Museum in Washington put me up to that, to go to the records at the other place.
Uh-huh.
To make sure, like they had, my parents were loaded in a cattle train, and in Munich it said they were taken to Riga, Latvia, executed there, but the train never made it to Riga. It stopped.
What I want to understand is what knowledge you are receiving at the time, because you get to Munich, and here is this vast trove of records. Was it a needle in a haystack to find your family in there?
No, no. It was filed under my regular name, Rice.
So you look up Rice.
Yeah.
And as you get to that spot, is your heart pounding a little bit? Or did you think you already knew what you were going to find?
I think I knew what I was going to find. I had enough stories. When we went across from the Rhine to Czechoslovakia, we were very close to the Belsen concentration.
Bergen-Belsen,
Bergen-Belsen. And there, you know, in the army, rumors fly. We knew that it was very bad.
But now you're opening up a file.
Yeah.
And you see right there, and it has your parents' name.
Yeah, it's in here. The only thing that was wrong is it didn't go to Riga, the gate went to Kaunas.
But you're looking at a paper that says your parents are dead.
Yeah, and my grandparents. My grandparents went to Theresienstadt.
And what about your brother?
Oh, he went with my parents.
What did that do to you, to see that in print?
Oh, it's hard to take, let's put it this way. If I would have had a German that was bothering me, I might have shot him, without question.
So you find out that your parents, your grandparents, your brother are all victims of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're also thinking at some point, that's what would have happened to me.
Sure.
Yet you go back to Nuremberg, and they still expect you to interrogate these guys.
Yeah.
So what'd you do?
I told the colonel I couldn't do it emotionally, and he understood.
You did some things in the Army in World War II that saved fellow soldiers' lives. The lives you most desperately wanted to save, your family, you couldn't because of Hitler. And now, all these years later, you develop a test that, I mean, I have to imagine, has helped save thousands of lives, if not millions.
Well, that's why I went to science, helped do some social work, to try to find out what's going on in your body and what we can do to improve diseases.
Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever tried to quantify
how
many people have survived or been able to treat prostate cancer because they got warning?
No, I don't know.
Do you think I'm off in my estimate?
I don't think so. It makes me feel proud that I was able to contribute something.
And ultimately, on that end, I guess we have your parents to thank for their foresight in sending you to this country.
Especially my mother, who constantly said to me, get educated. That's something they never can take away from you.
No, they could not. And he did everything he could to make sure memories of the Holocaust would be preserved as well. Oscar Rice honored the memory of his mother and the other members of his family who perished in the Holocaust by planting trees in the Martyrs' Forest outside of Jerusalem. Trees that, like that flame lit by 6 Holocaust survivors at Yad Vashem this week, serve as powerful reminders of a tragic crime against humanity that we all hope and pray will never be repeated. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Hometown Heroes today.
I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time for a special Mother's Day episode with a 104-year-old woman whose story of service in World War II is sure to not only turn your head, but also serve as one more reminder that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.